is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, beginning an oral history interview with Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer, U.S. Army retired. Today's date is the 30th of March, 2004. I am on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building interview room, and Dr. Kammermeyer is in Washington State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you help us out by giving us some general biographical information? Where were you born and when?
I was born in Oslo, Norway, in 1942, during the Nazi occupation of Norway.
Can you tell me a bit about your parents?
My father was a physician and was working with the Norwegian underground, and my mother was a nurse, and she, too, was working against the Nazis. But I think all of that becomes relevant later on in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because she ended up using me, my mother ended up using me as a decoy when they were moving weapons to the Norwegian underground, going right in front of the Nazis and running through town and all of that sort.
Now, what did your father do with the underground?
Well, their participation was primarily in sheltering of those who were active in sabotage and in moving things around to get to the resistance forces. So he worked at a hospital, but the main work was, like many Norwegians, was in support of and providing shelter for those who were more active in the actual resistance to the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Was your house, in some sense, a safe house or used that way?
Yeah, I guess you could call it that. We lived in an apartment right across from Nazi headquarters.
Where in Oslo was that?
It was north of the the Schloss, the palace,
yes.
And a street called Camilla, Camilla, new word, Kolitzvej. Kolitzvej, so it was, right. Norway or Oslo is a relatively small city by comparison to American cities.
Yes, I have been there.
Oh, okay.
And I was thinking now of where the Nazi headquarters was located.
It was in a hotel,
mm-hmm.
Right across the street.
What was the name of the hotel?
I don't recall, but last time I was in Norway, I saw it there.
Mm-hmm.
It looked a little bit like a small private hotel that one would see in a regular city. So,
mm-hmm.
it was sort of in a local residential area.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have big hotels there, but it was in good proximity to the downtown.
Where did your father train?
He was in Norway at the University of Oslo.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what about your mother? She was a nurse, is that right?
Yes. She was trained by the Red Cross, had training programs for registered nurses. So she was, I guess what they would call, she referred to herself as a Red Cross nurse, because that's where she got her training.
And your father and she, I assume now, cooperated in the resistance support work that you've described?
Yes.
They were both involved?
Yes.
Okay. Did they have friends who were also involved? How did it operate? Do you know much about it?
Well, the main thing I know is that you didn't talk about it. You only knew... you only had one contact person,
mm-hmm.
and so if one family was identified and targeted, they could not divulge the names of anyone else. So they had a cadre of friends that they would talk about getting together, but I don't recall any conversations as such about... the resistance work of their friends.
Mm-hmm. Were you the oldest child?
Yeah, I was the oldest. I was born during the occupation, and my mother used to tell stories of, you know, sort of ingrown behavior, because when we had people living with us who were, you know, trying to get out of the country or hide from the Nazis, we would all sit down at the dinner table, for example. But if anybody should knock on the door or the telephone would ring, our visitors would take their plate and move into the bedroom and sort of pretend that they were not there.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was growing up, I used to do the same thing because that's what the custom was.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came to the United States, my father was the first Norwegian to receive the Rockefeller Fellowship. And when we came to the United States and we were living with a very prominent family in Boston, the doorbell would ring or the telephone would ring, and I would take my plate and leave to go and hide somewhere. So I'm sort of raised in this very rude tradition, if you will, because obviously you couldn't say anything about it at the time because, you know, kids would then go and talk, and before you'd know it, the word would be out that there was something unusual going on.
So
I had to relearn proper etiquette.
Do you actually, in your own mind, have retained any memories of that occupation period?
You know, it is so hard to try to separate reality from reinforcement of stories. I've been back several times to the apartment building where we used to live.
Mm-hmm.
And because of probably my mother telling about what happened in various places, there are things that I think I see in my mind's eye, but that I would not say were, I wouldn't count on it being mine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were both of your parents born in Oslo? Were they natives?
They're both born in Norway. My father was born in Norway and then raised in Belgian Congo, where his father, my grandfather, was a physician down there for 12 years, and then he came back to Norway. My mother was born just outside of Oslo, and her father was a psychiatrist who was the founder of the first psychiatric hospital in Norway.
Now, what was his name?
His name was Grimsgaard, Grimsgaard.
And where did he train, do you know?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
Okay. And your, I gather, grandfather on the other side, who was down in Africa, can you talk about the circumstances? Do you know anything about the reasons for his location down there?
He was asked, from what I understand, he was asked by the Norwegian government to go and, sort of function as a missionary doctor. However, there was no religious component to his, I guess, a humanitarian work more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked down there, and my father and his sister both lived there for a good part of their youth.
Did that have any particular impacts on your father as he was an adult and later in his own career?
Well, I didn't ask him specifically, but
sure.
There were a couple of little things that I think, from what I could glean after I, you know, watched him over the years and
mm-hmm.
everything else. And one is going to sound very, very tacky. And I don't even know that it's appropriate for the discussion. But that he had a boy, which is what he called him.
Sure.
A young black young kid about his age who played with him and kept him company,
mm-hmm.
And took care of him for his entire stay down there. And you know, so he was always extremely polite to blacks in in the United States because there were no blacks in Norway.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But I think that he carried this notion that they were to care for the master, if you will.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't from bias. It was more from that's the way he had been raised.
Right. There was some background of his own in a different tradition.
Yeah.
Which doesn't
exactly.
You know, it doesn't apply in the United States, but is a different culture, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so I think you know that was something that he carried with him. And then when he returned to Norway, he was extremely naive about sort of the Norwegian traditions, if you will, and folklore, and I think he came from privilege in some ways of the expectations that things would fall into place for him. I don't know that he ever worked his way through school or did anything like that. And his own idea about the role of women were as certainly as subservient to men, and in part because they also did not carry the family name. And so because when they married, they then changed their name so that they were not as significant in the genealogy of culture. So we had a few discussions about that over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure. Now, did that play out between your mother and father, or was this kind of an abstract idea that he had?
No, I don't think it played out between my parents, because my mother was raised in the culture of women being subservient and being in the home and taking care of the kids and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But I think that ultimately it meant that her life was quite circumscribed, and that she did not reach her full potential, and I think she realized that later on in life. But my father's stuff,
yes,
if you will,
yes,
certainly played an impact with me.
Can you say a bit more about that?
Well, part of it was, as I was growing up, and this may be, you know, just personality more than anything else, but it was a sense of I could never be good enough to get praise. And part of it was because I was a girl.
Sure.
Yeah, so there was this notion, well, maybe if I could become a boy, that I would please my father.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that until I earned my doctorate, and my father was at the graduation and said, you know, I should have gotten my PhD.
Mm.
It was the first time it was like, the kid in me said, gotcha. but, you know, it was like, took a long time.
Yes.
Before I felt that there was, although he was very proud of my military career, I think it was a long time before I felt as though somehow I had sort of pleased him, if you will. And I think that, you know, that is no question but that's the kid in us.
Sure, sure. Yeah. It's an interesting relationship.
Yeah. And I had never wanted anything to do with neuro because that was my father's field, and I wanted to do everything and anything but what he was doing, and ended up specializing in neuroscience.
Right. No matter how you tried to avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. And you know, so it's like one of these yin and yang of things.
Yes, yes. I want to ask a little bit about the circumstances under which your family came to the United States. You mentioned that your father had a Rockefeller Fellowship. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right after the war, he was a neuropathologist by this time, and he received the fellowship and went to work in Boston, Massachusetts, under the mentorship, if you will, of Raymond Adams, who is the father of neurology. When I say that, we lived in their home and he was my father's best friend and all of that, I'm immediately elevated to, sitting on the right side of.
Right.
And he was there. Obviously, we came over with him. By that time, I had one younger brother and I.
Now, what year would this have been?
This would have been in 1946 to 47.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And so we lived for 9 months in Boston and then went back to Norway. And in about 1950, my father was asked to come to the United States to immigrate and to work for the American government in research. And so we immigrated then ultimately in 1951 to Washington, D.C., where he was a research scientist at what was then the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology when it was downtown where the Smithsonian Institute is now located.
Right.
And then the institute was being moved up to Walter Reed,
yes.
And he was asked to move to the National Institutes of Health, which he did, and worked there at NIH probably for 25 years.
Now, I should just clarify, could you give your father's full name?
It's his full name is Johan Widding, Widding, Heiberg, Heiberg, Kammermeier. Mm-hmm. But he went by Jan.
He went by Jan.
Yeah, okay. Jan, J-A-N.
Jan. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
And so he worked at the National Institutes of Health then for at least 25 years and had ended up, I think, publishing 97 papers and is still considered one of the foremost neuroanatomists and of his day and still has done some of his work is still being cited.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. For someone who didn't have even the barest grasp of neuroanatomy or neuropathology, could you just talk for a second about what that field entails?
Well, it's the brain and spinal cord, how it works and what things influence its ability to do what it does.
Okay.
And so when there are diseases, it is a neuropathologist who looks at the damage, the injury, the type of problem that might have physically occurred to account for certain physical symptoms.
Okay. And when your father was invited to come to the States in 1950, do you know the circumstances around that invitation? How was his name put forward?
I don't know. I can only assume that it probably came because of his work at in Boston.
Right, okay.
And that he was already getting a name internationally. And that's the only thing I can assume. I remember that when he became an American citizen in 1956 and was asked why he came and why he wanted to become an American citizen and the like, he said the freedom of research was the real moving opportunity for him that made coming to America very important and how appreciative it was because of that.
Were there any sadness feelings around leaving Norway that you know about? Was it a disruptive move? Or
I remember feeling devastated. I do remember that the trip to the plane and things. By this time, I was almost 9 years old.
Sure.
And I don't think that my parents had appreciated the impact that it would have on even on them. My mother didn't speak English very well. She certainly could be understood, but with a very heavy accent.
Mm-hmm.
But all of their friends were in Norway, and so there was, they never really ended up having a large social network to interact with. And I think that my mother particularly was very lonely. I remember them talking at some point about where they would retire, if they would go back to Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother died very prematurely, and so that no longer became an issue, but that she really missed her friends. And when she and my father went back to Norway for the first time, at the time that I got married, mm-hmm. and we went to Norway for our honeymoon, and she came to Germany for the wedding and then went to Norway, and she just absolutely loved being home, which it was for her.
Sure. Did she ever work outside of the home once she had moved to the States?
She did some work as a volunteer nurse at a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then what she had originally studied for was art. She was an artist. And when I was in high school, that was when she began to take up art again, and was silk screening and doing some really stunning design work,
wow.
some of which she was able to sell the patterns in New York for people to use for material for clothes and dresses.
How marvelous. I mean, was that quite fulfilling for her, do you think?
I think she thoroughly enjoyed it because it was a creative opportunity for her, and it also was the first time that she was able to get a little bit of private money, if you will,
sure.
Rather than being on an allowance, which was very degrading, but was still a part of the social culture at the time.
Yes, and an instrument of control, whether intended or not.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me ask about you. You said that you remember actually going to the plane. How did you find the adjustment to coming to the States?
Well, it was, I couldn't speak English.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So when I came, everything was new. I had, by this time, 1951, I had two brothers. And mainly what I recall is the departure as being sad.
Mm-hmm.
But getting to America, everything was so strange. And I think the first thing that I ever had to eat here was a banana. And
uh-huh.
how wonderful that tasted. And my father talking about how it was wonderful, but not quite the way it had been in Africa.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But over the years, as I was growing up, and because we moved a lot, going from one locality to another, but still within the greater Washington, D.C., Maryland area,
mm-hmm.
Never feeling that I had any roots or that I belonged anywhere or that I had a cadre of friends that would follow me along. And I think a little bit like, traveling, people who are in the military and travel,
yes.
and uproot their kids and,
yes.
Defense Department people, and mm-hmm. That the kids themselves end up having to be fairly autonomous and have a lot of personal ego strength because they don't get a social reinforcement from friends. And I think that you also then lose a little bit in terms of maturing emotionally because you don't have anybody to do that with. And so I had I don't have a lot of real, wonderful feelings of those probably first 4 or 5 years when I was in America because it was this struggling to learn the language and not be a fool,
mm-hmm.
and also to help my family. I little bit more about American culture.
I
took a great deal upon myself.
Sure. I was going to ask whether the moving around underscored or reinforced a pre-existing tendency towards autonomy, or whether it was sort of forced upon you, as it were.
Well, I think it was forced upon me, but I also think that it influenced what happened when I made decisions that I was going to get divorced, but that my children should stay with their father and not to fight that in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
Because for them, I thought it was more important that they have their roots and their friends and stability rather than to be jerked around because their mother, you know, had an epiphany.
Right. And so were you conscious of that when you were making those decisions about custody and all that? Were you conscious of your own experiences?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
It was not the only factor, but
sure.
It certainly was something that, you know, to uproot them just for my own ego would have been, I think, a very, very bad thing. And now to see them as young adults and that they have friends that they had from when they were in elementary school, and it's just reinforces the fact that I made the right decision.
Yeah, that must feel very good. Why was it that your parents were moving around within the greater D.C. area?
Well, part of it was my father not realizing the cost factor.
Sure.
And so when we first moved there, he ended up buying a house that was more than we could afford because we had absolutely nothing. And so everything that had to be purchased. So part of it, with the first house, it was this overextending.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving to a smaller place that was more reasonable and that we could afford. And then when he changed jobs from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology to the National Institutes of Health, one was in downtown Washington, D.C., and NIH is in Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay.
So then it was moving closer to the work there,
mm-hmm.
and then there were a number of moves in each of those areas.
Uh-huh.
There were two or three moves in one in D.C., and then there was I think two moves in Maryland also.
Okay.
So that ultimately where they ended up was about a couple of miles from the National Institutes of Health, and where I spent my last year before I graduated from high school.
Now, what high schools did you attend? I take it more than one.
Yeah, I was my last 2 years, and I graduated from Walter Johnson High School, and the other was the first year was at the Bethesda Chevy Chase High School.
And what kind of a student were you in high school?
Average.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
I considered myself a genius. I think we have the tendency to do that when we don't study and pass.
Okay, right.
And I was president of the Girls Athletic Association.
Uh-huh.
And so I was focusing on sports. I had been playing semi-professional softball for a couple of years, not school-related, but with a sponsor. And so a lot of my focus was on sports, but also an interest in medicine.
No.
And I had a lab in my bedroom where I did sort of cut up eyeballs and had formaldehyde. And, you know, it was like taking my father's lab and putting it into my own bedroom where I could cut and paste and work and things.
And
So I had the delusion of grandeur that I was going to be some sort of a scientist.
Okay. Did you do well, or were you interested in the science classes in high school, or did you want to just find out on your own?
No, I did pretty well. And you know, I was not a straight A student.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably a B plus student.
Okay.
But maybe a B student.
The truth comes out.
Yeah. I did pass.
Yes. Well, there we go. Yeah. But science, in terms of academics, was
yeah,
the
science,
draw?
Yeah, science, math were the fields that I was interested in. So when I started college, I went to the University of Maryland.
Right.
My first year took microbiology, chemistry, zoology, and math and English, and was working part-time and ended up finding some friends and having a lot of partying time.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those are not compatible.
No, that's true. Yeah. That's fair.
And so my at that time, my dream of going into medicine sort of was quashed because I did not do well my first semester and realized that I had to make some changes. And ended up actually changing from pre-med to nursing. And that always felt very degrading because nursing at that time, the profession was, you know, just a... Actually, it fit very much with my sense of self-esteem with regard to my father.
Okay.
So I struggled and really did not... It was a very difficult emotional time, and this was actually a time also where I began to do some self-destructive stuff.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, looking back, it was realizing there was a cry for help in a lot of different ways, mm-hmm. but I began cutting myself.
Uh-huh.
And not suicidal type, but more, analyzing it, that I was in such emotional turmoil that having something physical was a way of taking that out and dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it was somewhere in the early college year where I began to question, you know, on a very subliminal level, wondering if there was something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And not having a... not having a label as such, but still wondering, because feeling different, acting different. I'm tall, so that some of my tendencies are to be a caretaker for the smaller people.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Things like opening doors and shaking
yeah.
hands when it before it was the custom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had began to question, you know, why was I different? And it turns out that I did end up having some friends who were lesbians, but mm-hmm. it didn't really compute
right.
as being perhaps something related to me also, but it was something that was not something that you really wanted to know, but
sure.
that you think that that's probably the case. And I was extremely naive sexually anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this undercurrent of uncertainty about myself at the time. And that stayed with me for a number of years until I, between my sophomore and junior year in college, ended up going back to Norway for the first time since I had immigrated,
mm-hmm.
and realizing that the reason I felt different, and it was a relief, the reason I felt different was because I was Norwegian.
Okay.
And the way I was acting and feeling was very much like other Norwegians. And so if things didn't work out in America, I could always go back to Norway. And there was this huge sense of, you know, there's nothing wrong with me other than mm-hmm. being a foreigner.
Mm-hmm. And
so that was a relief.
And that became kind of the explanation that you had for yourself about your disquiet?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't come up again for a number of years, that maybe I hadn't quite analyzed things.
Right.
Right.
There may have been another layer to go through yet.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that a little bit as we go on.
Yeah.
I want to ask just a few questions about this period that we've been talking about. And the first thing that comes to mind, I think future listeners may be interested in, is this semi-pro softball league that you were in, or team that you played for.
I didn't know that playing softball was an early sign that maybe you were a lesbian.
But it apparently is diagnostic.
Yeah, that's what I came to find out. A high school acquaintance of mine, her sister played semi-pro ball, and she had seen me playing in high school mm-hmm. and suggested that I should go and see her sister play ball, and so invited me to one of their games, and of course it was wonderful. They really were good ball players and asked me to try out,
uh-huh.
and I was probably 14 at the time, and I really had a strong arm and loved the game, and so tried out and made it.
And what was the age group of others who were playing?
Probably early 20s to mid-30s.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so these were, you know, women who were very athletic and really fun to be around. And when we traveled up and down the East Coast, they brought their guitars and their baritone ukes. And so it was like every city that we went to play a game, it was like a big hootenanny afterwards. And I was the team mascot.
Sure, I bet you were.
And they were just wonderful. And I wasn't old enough to drive, so my mother would drive me to practice and everything. And one day she said, "Now, you realize that some of the people that you're playing ball with are homosexual. It's nothing to worry about. It's just an illness. But just so that you know that."
Uh-huh.
I really didn't know what that meant.
Okay.
But it was like, okay, you know, so I've been told.
Uh-huh.
And that was the only comment that was ever made, and this would have been in 1959. At that time, homosexuality was considered a mental illness. My
sure.
mother, you know, from her nursing and psychiatric background, you know, was familiar with that
mm-hmm.
as something, and so that was I think the first and only time that we ever had any discussion about homosexuality. But I continued to play ball, and I never, you know, I never saw anything. Nobody ever hit on me. It was just, it doesn't mean there wasn't some pairing up that I wasn't aware of.
Sure, sure.
It was just one of those wonderful childhood experiences that made me really feel like I was part of something.
Now, what was the name of the team that you played for?
Arcade, ARCADE,
mm-hmm.
Pontiac,
okay.
After the sponsor.
Sure. And that was a dealership, I take it?
Yes.
And what What were some of the other teams that you played? Do you remember anything about the league? And
No, I know that we played some teams in Washington, D.C., in Maryland. We went up to Pennsylvania and down to Virginia.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so there were a number of, but I don't recall the league itself.
Now, did you play through your high school years, or how long did you actually participate?
I played for 3 years, so I played through my senior year of high school.
Okay, and the league, as far as you know, continued on?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Uh-huh. And did you keep track of any of the friends that you had made?
No, but many, many years later, the woman who had introduced me to her sister who was playing ball, she and I ended up talking again after my case became notorious. So she had kept up with a few of the people, because obviously one was her sister and then a friend of her sister's, and that apparently they were all doing well.
Now, did you try to play sports while you were at college?
Yeah, this was before Title X.
Sure.
And so I was looking for an outlet, and I was trying to practice the discus and javelin and some things like that, but ended up playing some basketball, sort of intramural, but there was no team sport as such. And with the studies and the playing and the drinking and partying that I was doing, that there wasn't an opportunity to have the discipline of somebody taking me under their wings and putting me on a team that.
Right.
You know, so I think I regret that more than anything else, of not having had an opportunity for women in those days to participate in sports.
Yes, it was a hard one set of opportunities for women.
Yeah.
And an important one, I think. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the shift that you made from pre-med to nursing. You talked about that as being, you know, as highly provocative for you personally in terms of your own thinking about your career. Did the possibility of having a government program to support nursing studies for you have any role in your shifting to that?
Well, the first shift was having to make a decision to get out of pre-med.
Yes.
And at the time, I had a conversation with my mother. I was thinking about dropping out of school, because what else was worth going to school for? And she said, well, you know, with your experience, you could wash glass beakers at a laboratory, or, you know, she was essentially saying you have no education.
Okay, right.
And, you know, what are you going to do if you quit school? And realizing that I had to make some decision about that, and then deciding to go into nursing, it was an agonizing one because of my perception of nursing, which was probably pretty real at the time.
Yes.
And extremely subservient. So it reinforced me not feeling good about myself. So I was struggling during my sophomore year and doing more self-destructive stuff and drinking and still going to school, but certainly just marginally.
Yes.
And then somewhere in there, I ended up meeting a woman who whose sister had joined the Army as an Army nurse.
Uh-huh.
And that there was a program, the Army Student Nurse Program, where the government paid for 2 years of college in exchange for 3 years of active duty. And so I looked into that, and in my, I think it was the beginning of a shift of, if I'm going to go into nursing, then why not do that in an area where you can do something meaningful? And the meaningful part being an Army nurse, where you would be on the front where the action was, taking care of the American soldier in need. And so there was a psychological shift of doing something meaningful, and then the ego thing also of I can give something back to America because of what America has given to my family and my father. So then it became self-martyrdom. So I joined the Army Student Nurse Program and began to really have a feeling that this was a good thing for me to be doing, and it had all of these higher noble causes. And psychologically, between joining the military and going back to Norway on that visit, my last 2 years of college were totally different because I began to feel as though there was a sense of purpose, and it was a good one, and that I was going to do something that was meaningful, even in nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very important thing. And the fact that I now could get paid to go to school meant that I didn't have to work, and finances were not a problem because my parents were unable to help me out.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was a huge factor.
Now, did it also in some way impose a structure on your studies and that may have had its own rewards?
Well, at the University of Maryland, The last two years of college are in Baltimore, at the time it was in the slums, and there was absolutely nothing to do up there. So there really was. I don't think the military provided that much of a structure, but I think being in a different place did. So it was just more conducive.
Okay.
And you got to see patients. And so the whole aspect of training changed from the classwork to the hospital.
So there were fewer distractions in a way.
Yeah, and you were where you were beginning to focus your clinical work. And so the relevance of the schoolwork to what you were going to do professionally came together and were more synchronous.
So it was less abstract than the earlier classroom work. Can you tell a little bit about what requirements the Army Student Nurse Program made on you?
I had to do well in school.
Okay.
And be physically fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up doing a little bit of recruiting for them also because I was the first student at the University of Maryland that had joined the Army Student Nurse Program, and so there were opportunities to do public relations things and have some of my classmates join and do PR stuff and have pictures taken and things like that. But the main thing for us was academically to do well enough to pass and then to pass the state board exam and be ready to go on active duty when all was said and done.
And were your parents supportive of this action that you took?
Initially, they were a little concerned and talked to some of their friends who were very concerned because women didn't join the military. That would mean that they were homosexual or whores.
Okay.
So the notion of having me go in, they had a lot of concerns about that, but after the initial discussion, and when I decided that I was going to do it anyhow, they were very supportive.
And did that support continue, for example, throughout the rest of your mom's life?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. She was usually sad when I was overseas.
Sure.
We didn't see one another. And
yeah.
When I was in Vietnam and called her on the phone, she asked me not to do that anymore because it was so difficult to talk with me. So, throughout my military career, they thought that it was a good thing.
Now, I'm assuming that after graduation you went to the officer basic course. Is that correct?
Yeah, I had to wait until I passed my state board exam.
Okay.
So graduation was in June, I think the state board was in early July or something like that. And then I went on active duty in August.
And that would be 1963?
1963. August, went to Fort Sam Houston, Texas for the officer's basic.
And do you remember arriving down here in Texas?
Well, yes. I remember the telegram that I got.
Okay.
Because it was so cryptic, and I got it on a Sunday night, and it was like, what in the world does this mean? So I called the Pentagon and ended up talking to the officer of the day. And
really?
Read him. Well, you know, I knew nothing else to do.
Sure.
I mean, the Pentagon, I'm in government,
right.
I was in military. So he helped decipher the telegram for me, and I caught the next plane out of Dulles and flew down to San Antonio. And, you know, I was traveling in uniform, but didn't know. I knew that I was had put on the brass correctly, but I didn't know anything about protocol.
Okay.
Uh-huh. What are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to take your hat off in the airport? Do you take it off outside? Are you supposed to salute? How do you salute? You know, all of this stuff.
Right.
And so when I got down to Fort Sam, then it was, you know, getting signed in and everything, and slowly began to become acclimated. But the first time, there's a tradition in the military that the first person that salutes you, you are supposed to give a dollar to.
Okay. Uh-huh. I hadn't heard that.
It was also the time, because this was 1963, and women in the military were frowned upon by men. And so many times they would walk across the street so that they wouldn't have to salute you because you were
sure.
superior in rank to them. And so it was really awkward, but eventually there was that first person that first enlisted person that saluted me that I gave a dollar to, and it was like this huge sigh of relief of, oh, that's over.
Yes, a rite of passage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Can you tell how big the class was in your basic course?
Well, we probably had about 60 people or so, and I, or maybe even 90. I ended up, because I was the tallest in the group, ended up being a platoon leader. And
were they clear on that as being the reason? Did they convey that to you?
Well, there was absolutely no other reason.
Okay.
I mean, it couldn't have been. I mean, you don't stand out in a sea of green uniforms where everybody is equally ignorant, other than by height.
Now, how tall are you actually? Just for
I'm a little over 6 feet.
Okay, there you go. So, what did a platoon leader get to do or have to do?
Well, you were responsible for your troops and making mm-hmm. sure that they were there properly in uniform, that they marched properly. That, you know, you had drill instructors to help you with that, but I mean, ultimately, that they were ready for inspection and looked smart and acted smart and were in the right sequence of things. And I mean, it was all the military stuff that you see in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite wonderful.
Why do you say that?
Was that quite wonderful?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was something wonderful about being part of a group that represent, you know, we were representing America. We were getting ready to be all that we could be, if you will.
Right.
As the nurse corps, we also were in competition with all of the other men who were in other corps and also down at Fort Sam.
Yes.
So it was, you know, can we look better than they? And there was a certain competitiveness that went along with working towards equality of treatment. And as women, we really wanted to excel and not feel that we were tokens.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you have to compete on equal terms.
Now, did you have downtime such that you could have informal discussions with the other women about some of these issues?
I think the downtime was social time.
Okay, sure.
We did a lot of studying, and then we had you know, a place for happy hour where we ended up talking you know, with the guys.
Uh-huh.
More than anything else, and doing comparison stuff. But I don't think it was a time of actually talking about what it meant to be a woman in the military, because
okay.
many were still focusing on not their own careers, but rather even looking for a man.
Sure.
Because if they ended up finding a man and could get married, then their obligation to the military was out.
Right.
You could not be a woman in the military married in 1963.
Was any of that on your radar, or were you there to discharge your duty?
Oh, I was not interested. That had never been my intent to get married. I was going to be the first woman general in the Army Nurse Corps. There's nothing, you know, small about my ego.
Okay, and you had that in mind as a goal right
yeah.
away?
Yeah,
okay.
that was my early goal, because there were no generals in the female generals in the military.
Well, who was the highest ranking officer? Do you know, or what was her rank?
A colonel. There were five women colonels all total in the Army Nurse Corps, and I think Hazel Johnson may have been the chief of the Army Nurse Corps at that time.
And I would presume that those women were either on duty stations somewhere else or in D.C. So
yeah, they were in D.C.
Okay. Did you ever meet any of those women when you were yet at this basic training level or at the advanced course?
No.
Okay. They didn't come out to attend your graduation or anything like
no,
that?
No.
Okay. Was this the only place, was Fort Sam the only place that was training for the Nurse Corps at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And still.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you had, I'm sorry, maybe 60 to 90 people in that women.
I think probably 90, because I think we had three platoons.
Were any of them from your neck of the woods there in the D.C. area?
No, not that I. Nobody that I know knew one another previously.
I see. Okay. Did you do weapons training?
Not at that time. We were out in the... Let me see. I don't believe so, because the requirement for women to become familiarized with weapons, I believe, took place in the early 70s.
Okay, so that just wasn't part of the program.
No, ours, and it was also part of the Geneva Convention that nurses and healthcare workers and chaplains did not bear arms.
And was that something that you were learning about during the basic course?
Yeah. Okay. We learned all about the Geneva Convention, and, both military and medical aspects of what we were supposed to be doing. Administrative things and paperwork, and then we, the basic training that I had was 10 weeks long.
Okay, uh-huh.
And we spent some time out at Bullis, which was the field area, and we saw mock war attacks, and we were involved in litter bearing courses and triage and we had to impregnate our fatigues, because they were the old green fatigues, and we had to soak them in a type of disinfectant so that the mosquitoes wouldn't attack. It just was so rank. We learned to polish our boots, and how you get in and out of a vehicle depending upon your rank, and who walks to the right or the left of whom, and all of the protocol was part of our training there. How to fill, work in a hospital and fill out a chart and take care of patients. We had some clinical time, but most of it was classroom, and we did drill and ceremony type of things outside, marching, and before the days of physical training. As I'm talking to you, I'm trying to visualize, pulling out the memories of the various events that we were involved with.
Mm-hmm. You're doing a good job. The course, as you say, lasted about 10 weeks. Did you have a graduation ceremony?
Yes. Yes, we did, and it was outside and in uniform, and, so all of us looked our best.
And was that the point at which you were commissioned?
No. I had, because I was in the Army Student Nurse Program, I had gotten my commission 6 months before graduation.
Okay. Were you a second lieutenant? Or?
I was a second lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I went on active duty, it was just an additional year before I became a first lieutenant, because it was an 18-month lapse. Between second and first lieutenant. So when I went on active duty, I already had 6 months in.
Yeah, you were already on the clock.
Yeah.
And proceeding towards your star, I guess. did you, what happened after basic? What was the next?
Then I had wanted to go to Germany because I had such bad feelings about Germans.
Okay.
In general, and having been raised where I was, and realizing that, I needed to find out if my antagonism was real or if it was just based on my bias that I was raised under.
Yes.
And so I requested a tour in Germany, but the practice at that time was that if you were right out of a four-year program, that you needed to learn how to do nursing. And so you needed a six-month stateside assignment first, and I ended up going to Fort Benning, Georgia, at Martin Army Hospital, and which was also the infantry training and ranger training and officer candidate school training site.
And this would have been at somewhere near the end of 1963?
Yes. Would have let's see, July, so August, September. So it would probably have been in early September or early October.
Okay.
And so I was then at Martin Army Hospital for 6 months. I worked the women's ward, which I thought was, it was like, why would I want to work the women's ward, for gosh sakes? I was wanting to be, a soldier's nurse.
Sure. Uh-huh.
So that felt like weird. And then I also worked at the intensive care unit for a while. And what they were trying to provide was a clinical experience so that we could put everything that we had learned in college into action and experience, and the things from basic training about how to do the paperwork, and it was an extraordinarily important time for me on many levels, because I learned how to be a compassionate, caring, I think sensitive nurse, to deal with also death and dying, because it was when I was in the intensive care unit, was the first time that I had seen the effect of women not having a right to choose about their body. A young woman in her early 20s who had two kids. Her husband was always on the go and with the military, and she had gotten pregnant and decided that she could not deal with a third child, and she had used a knitting needle to self-abort and became septic and ended up in the intensive care unit, jaundiced, infected, comatose, and dying. And it had such a profound effect on me that when the discussions about women's right to choose came up, there was just no question but that I would support that. And to this day, you know, when the discussions come up about women's right to choose and late-term abortion, all of this nonsense, she is the person that I see.
Colonel, did she actually die?
Yeah.
Okay. Were you conscious at the time of the sort of political background to her individual case, or was it something that you've come to think about later on?
No, I realized it at the time also. But it was, so this was 63, and the discussion about women's right to choose was really not in the forefront yet.
No, that's right.
From what I recall, but rather that, because I'd also had a couple of my classmates who had gotten pregnant and had asked if I would help, and I think a part of me always feels a certain amount of guilt of not feeling that I could risk helping them.
Sure.
And so I knew that there was an issue. But, you know, many of us think that at the time we were growing up that sex was to be saved until you were married. And, you know, so there are some repercussions, and you'd be sent to the women's, you know, Florence Crittenden Home for Wayward Girls.
Yes.
Pregnant, and I mean, all of this bizarre stuff that we, but, you know, I thought that Jesus was, you know, came about through Immaculate Conception, so I was really a slow learner.
Right. Were there other cases from this first period of intense practical activity within the military that stuck in your mind?
There had been a helicopter crash at Fort Benning where we had, I believe it was 10 or 12 casualties, and all of us were mobilized, and we ended up creating a burn unit at the hospital with sheets separating the each of the patients, and all of us dressing in sterile clothing, and these absolutely charred, devastated young men in the various stages of dying.
Sure.
And some being evacuated to Fort Sam Houston, where they had the burn center,
right,
and then dying in the it was a horrible, horrible experience. That and the smells and the angst.
Yes.
Tough time.
Did you learn things from this experience? This would probably have been your first mass cal of any kind.
Well, I think it sort of. I don't know that at the time that it was clear in my mind that the organization and the teamwork and things that one needed to do to respond to such an emergency and disaster, that it could take place. I don't know that that was really clear at the time. I think that as I look back, it certainly was made an impression that we really could respond at any time and any place to any situation.
Yeah.
And that we had the resources to do that. And I think, you know, ultimately in my experience in the military, where I was an educator, teaching troops to what they needed to know to go to Vietnam, and my own experience later in Vietnam, and then as chief nurse of setting up a mass casualty situation that involved the hospital, not external to it, but that we did a mock casualty, the hospital itself being hit and how people would respond to
sure.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was realizing that having the opportunity to be involved in something like that makes you better for the next time.
Yes, yes, a little more self-confident maybe around your own capabilities.
Yeah, and seeing where the biggest holes were was, mm-hmm. You know, in a field exercise that I conducted, then it was the biggest hole was finding and identifying and being able to identify who was in charge and the need
right.
to have a, you know, even if it's a simple thing like a yellow hat or something to say, here's the boss.
Okay, uh-huh,
uh-huh. But those are, you know, important and, but, you know, I think I am digressing.
Well, I want to ask you about your move on to Germany. When did those orders come through, or did you already know while you were at Fort Benning that Germany would be your next
station? We asked, we put in requests and gave our three top preferences.
Yes.
And when at Fort Benning, I had a roommate. We had we shared an apartment. Uh-huh. Another nurse that was there that I had met there, who happened to be as tall as I.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately, I was her maid of honor in her wedding, and she was my matron of honor at my wedding.
I see. Uh-huh.
So I had applied to be sent to Germany, and when the 6 months was up, I ended up getting orders to go to Nuremberg, and that's what I did.
Do you recall your trip over to Germany? Were you excited about going, or were you apprehensive? Do you remember?
Well, you know, the thing about the military is you don't have to worry.
Yeah.
Because you've got orders, and you're told exactly where to report and what to do, so that nothing is really left to chance.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to try to figure out how to get from point A to point B, because somebody's going to be at point A to take you to point B.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And so there was a certain sense of I think, excitement, because, among other things, I had an aunt who lived in Germany. And so I was looking forward to meeting her,
mm-hmm.
Or seeing her again, and that this was part of the next part of my journey. And getting to Germany and then getting to the hospital and being there was, I think, a very meaningful. You know, I still one of the things that I learned that I think persists and helps me realize that you don't escape your own biases.
Uh-huh.
Is that I certainly learned that not every German is a Nazi.
Yes.
And that my hatred of what the Nazis stood for does not need to be generalized to the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
But realizing also that gut feeling comes up first whenever there is a discussion about either the war or about Germany or about you know, anybody who is German, you know, there's that immediate gut response because it came there first.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to exercise reason.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And I have the same thing with my bias about Vietnam. Okay. And that gut feeling that will come up because that's what's there first. And so for, and even my own homophobia, you know, that internalized homophobia is what will come up first when I have to make a decision on whether or not to come out or to discuss something about my personal life. Diane and I just got married, and so
congratulations.
but so even little things like that, it's like, who do we tell? You know, are they going to be, you know, rejecting?
Sure.
It's like, hey, you know, it's not about them. It's about the celebration and stuff like that. And so it allows me, I think, a better understanding of human nature now as we are trying to sort of change the social makeup.
Yes.
And why our children and younger people aren't caught up in the same homophobic responses as our generation and the older generation.
It's a different agenda.
So that, you know, we really are moving. It's just that our generation isn't.
Right.
and I think, you know, for that reason, that the move to Germany, I'm going to tie it all together.
That's okay, good. That's okay.
The move to Germany really was very important because it gave me the vision then of understanding where the underlying bias comes from versus the reality.
While you were in Germany, did you have a chance to, or did you take an opportunity to go to places other than where you were stationed and to kind of get a sense of the country as it was then?
I lived off post.
Okay.
On the economy, as
sure.
it was called, and had an apartment with in the home of a German couple, and my aunt lived. I was stationed in Nuremberg, and she lived up in Cologne, so I would travel up there to visit them often, and after. Harvey and I met. We traveled around a lot to German cities and saw the, you know, the architecture and the places and did sightseeing, stuff like that. I also took a 2 semesters of German from a university, through the University of Maryland, but there was a German professor who lived in Nuremberg, who taught the German there. So we ended up having a little social time with him in addition to the classes to see a little bit about what the rest of the Germans lived like. But I think, by and large, also spent time with our colleagues, and you can certainly become isolated.
Sure. Yes. I was wondering if you visited any of the points so notoriously associated with the Nazi regime.
Yeah. Nuremberg, of course, was a hub. And the center there, I'm trying to think, the Sportsplatz.
Yes.
Was where Nazi had, or Hitler had his big rallies and everything. And, you know, you would go there and realizing the true shock and awe of the horror of the times and how people just had gotten totally caught up in all of that horror and participating in it. And one of my dear friends that I was raised with in Norway, she was stationed in Munich, and she and I went to Dachau together.
Okay. Can you talk about that experience just briefly, if you would?
Well, Dachau was a concentration camp just outside of Munich, where, among others, there were a number of Norwegians that were cremated.
Yes.
and died. And they have a memorial there, but they also had the crematorium so that you could walk through. And it's hard to look at it just like a museum of some kind. And for both my girlfriend and myself, it was, we wondered who of our parents' friends might have ended up there. Mm-hmm. So there was the nationalism of being a victim and wondering about our own connection and realizing the horror of what had gone on there. So it was very, very moving. And, again, one of those things that you don't erase from your memory because it's
right,
there.
The place itself, I gather, has changed over the years. And I wonder, can you describe sort of how it was set up? Were you able to walk in with no sort of check-in or governance? How many people were there that day? Can you give a sense of what it was like to kind of visit that place?
Well, from what I recall, it was not the entire place that was still intact,
okay,
but only a small portion of it.
Yes.
And that there was a statue with, not a statue, but, you know, an architectural designed place where there was a, somehow in my mind I see some long metal spikes and going into this building that held the crematorium and the oven, and that there were pictures of what it was like when it was active, and also the names of some people from various countries. It was not very large, and there were not a lot of people, because we felt that, but it was like a quiet place, to say the least, because of the enormity of what had transpired there. But there was no guards. I don't think that we had to pay to get in or something. It was just a place that was a memorial.
I see. Okay. What was the work that you were doing at the base?
I was at the 90th Station Hospital in Nuremberg, and initially worked the intensive care recovery orthopedic ward. The hospital was one of these huge, long buildings that had about four floors on it, and it must have been a barracks at one time. No, actually, that was not true. It used to be a German hospital that was then converted to an American hospital, but one floor had 76 patients on it, and initially I worked on what was half the floor, where you had the trauma unit and the intensive care and recovery and orthopedics and surgery. And so it was quite a mindset change, because we had trauma injuries that were flown in from the military training area up at Grafenwehr, where all of the artillery and armor training took place, right on the border to East Germany.
Yes.
And there were a number of casualties that would be flown in by helicopter, and then we would take care of them up on our ward. I remember not having had trauma experience and stuff. One of the things you learn very quickly is that your sergeants know everything. by the fact that they're a sergeant means that they've been in the military probably 5 to 10 years, and having worked as a medic, that they're exposed to things that we were not in our training as nurses.
Sure.
And so if you were smart, especially when you had the excuse of being a butterbar, which was a second lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
You're excused for a lot of things then. So you could observe a sergeant doing certain things so that you could learn yourself. Mm-hmm. And you could not let your ego get in the way of just because you were an officer and they were an enlisted person.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Not giving them due credit for what they knew. And it was very smart. And I learned very quickly how experienced they were and how professional and extraordinary in the care. So they were my teachers.
Can you remember any of their names?
No.
Any of those people's names?
No.
Who were you reporting to? What was the command structure like for you?
In the hospital, a staff nurse, usually a second lieutenant or a first lieutenant. In many cases, the head nurse of a particular ward is a captain, sometimes
yes.
a major,
okay.
depending on how many of each they had. And so you, as the nurse, you are in charge of all of the activities that take place on the ward. And then at the change of shift, you report off to the next incoming shift with the nurse and all of the enlisted people that are going to provide the care for the next 12 hours or
okay.
8 hours.
Uh-huh.
And the nurse or the senior sergeants are usually the ones that divide the tasks up or they assign not only the tasks but also the patients to a particular corpsman or to a particular nurse.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So that the senior nurse is the one that always is ranking and responsible for everything that does or does not take place. And then above all of these, there may be, for example, a staff of 15 or 20 that are assigned to a ward.
Mm-hmm.
And the head nurse is the senior ranking person. And this is regardless of where you are around the country.
Sure.
In terms of military hospitals.
Okay.
Except in rare instances where a civilian nurse might be assigned as a head nurse.
But
normally it's always
right.
the ranking military nurse that is the head nurse of that particular ward. Each ward within a hospital has a supervisor, or there's a supervisor that is responsible for a number of wards.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is then an assistant chief nurse and a chief nurse. So we are all of the nursing care activities come under the hierarchy that begins with a hospital chief nurse and then down the pecking order.
Now, at this point, Were you still feeling quite ambitious about your military career?
I don't think that I had, the thing about the structure of the military is that because it is so structured, you will move up the hierarchy, if you will, very time-based.
Yes.
And so you don't think about being a general when second lieutenant.
Right, okay.
You think about becoming a first lieutenant.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then you think about becoming a captain. And then you think, and then what the job opportunities are along the way. So you certainly don't have the arrogance to say that I'm going to be your general.
Right. Without the passage of time, that's not going to happen.
Exactly. So it was more, I think, feeling that I was very comfortable in the setting and that I enjoyed the military, and I was growing and learning along the way.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of learning, during the time that you were in Germany. You mentioned picking up things from the sergeants who knew how to get things done. Were there other things that you learned during this assignment that were helpful to you later on?
Yeah. It was the first time that I actually disobeyed an order.
Okay.
And when you are raised in believing that an order is like a calling from God and you're going to be struck down, refusing a lawful order, then it was a very significant thing for me. I was on night duty on a medical ward. I had nearly 76 patients. I'd moved from the intensive care unit up to a medical unit.
Okay.
And there was the beginning of a cardiac care unit. This was before the days where these specialty units were created. So we had three critically ill cardiac patients who had had fresh myocardial infarctions or heart attacks.
Yes.
And I received, and I was working, believe it or not, with two other corpsmen with all of these patients. And I got a call from the chief nurse's office to say that I needed to report downstairs immediately because there had been an alert. That's, in case of an imminent attack, making sure that everybody was ready to go and that you're called out from your home and they have a telephone tree and everything so that everybody has to report in.
Sure.
And I looked at my patients and I said, I cannot come at this particular time until I have a relief up here. And the supervisor said, Lieutenant, this is a direct order. And I said, well, I will have to refuse the direct order because of my patients. And then I ended up getting two other phone calls directing me to go downstairs and this. And what I realized, and being in Germany, it was also, and I recall having this sense of, if I had been a German, I would not have done what the Nazis did, because what I realized was that my principle and ethic would have, at risk, whatever that personal risk was, I would not defy what I believed. And ultimately, there was a physician that came a little bit early, and I said, I needed to go downstairs to report in and ask him to cover the ward for me. So I went downstairs, and expecting that I was going to be stripped of rank and privilege and everything, and by this time they had heard what the patient situation was up in the ward, and so apologized for putting me in a very awkward position. But what I realized was that I would stand up to what I thought at that time was a very, a very frightening experience of perhaps losing my military career for refusing an order.
But it did prove something to yourself. You proved something to yourself about your own assessment of what had happened in Germany as well.
Yeah, I realized a whole bunch about myself.
Oh, yeah.
That I would stand on principle, regardless of the consequences. And curiously, that is what I ended up doing on a number of occasions.
Yes, yes, you did. Yes, you have. Somewhere in here, I gather you met Harvey. Can you talk about that for a moment?
We were introduced on a four-way blind date. A friend of a friend of a friend thought that he and I ought to meet because we were both tall and both officers and both in the military. And so they set us up on a blind date, and we dated for a year, had some rocky things along the way, I mean, that are not that particularly interesting, but
sure.
They're just...
Sure.
At one point, I decided I really wasn't in love with him, and so I broke off our dating, and he was devastated and said that he wanted to get back together. I said I didn't want to see him for 30 days, and because I was feeling like I was losing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And when the 30 days were up, he ended up asking me to marry him, and I really wasn't sure that I had an option, and so I agreed to, and at the same time thinking that I had lost myself, and so it was a very curious dilemma.
Did you feel that you didn't have an option because he had asked you? I mean, he had asked you, so therefore you didn't have an option.
Before. Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. Uh-huh.
It's I was very, very naive about a lot of things, and that was one of them. If you don't have an excuse, it's a little bit like my father would always say no. And to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was no discussion about it afterwards or anything like that. And then he would, I remember feeling that, you know, I was not going to do that, but I was going to, instead of saying no all the time, asking why not.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he asked, it was why not? And I couldn't think of a rational reason. I said yes.
And you did actually get married to him. When did you actually get married?
In August.
Of
65.
Okay.
We had met in August of 64, so 1 year later. Can you hold just 1 second?
Sure.
We were,
We were talking about Harvey and your decision to
accept his... So I didn't think of a reason, couldn't think of a reason, so I said yes. And but I do remember thinking that my life is over.
Wow.
And yet never taking that as a hint that maybe I should relook at this.
What were the military implications of you getting married? Were there any?
At that time, the policy had changed so that women could marry and be in the military.
Okay.
However, you still could not have children and be in the military.
Right.
And so we had not planned on a family immediately. He had some time left on his obligation, and I think I guess I had another year also, but I had wanted to stay in the military, so, you know, we were just dealing with one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
The main, implication was what happens when we leave Germany. As it turned out, I had wanted to go to Fort Lewis because that's where Harvey was from, and so we had thought about me being reassigned and going back there. So I had put Fort Lewis as one of my requests for my next duty assignment, and he ended up getting assigned to Fort Lee, Virginia. And so I wrote a letter to my my people.
Mm-hmm.
Said that I wanted to remain in the military, but I could only do so if I could be reassigned with my husband, who was now going to Fort Lee. And so they changed my orders, and we were both reassigned. I was reassigned and ended up going to Fort Lee, Virginia with him in 1966, I think it was.
Okay. And just for the record, Harvey's last name was Hawken. Did you take that last name?
I did, okay. because women did that.
Sure.
And that was another part of feeling like I had lost myself,
mm-hmm.
if I had even lost my name. And now when my own children marry, I watch their wives take my son's name, and I think, you know, it's not a good idea. I don't say anything.
Right.
It's not my business, but yeah. At least in my mind, mm-hmm. To become Mrs. somebody rather than to maintain your own identity is I think, a shame, because you are raised with this other identity, and then to take on a different name. I mean, it was the first thing I changed when I was divorced, mm-hmm. was I took my name back.
And how did that make you feel?
When I took it back?
Yes.
It was like the beginning of a healing,
mm-hmm.
I was lost, but now I'm found.
I see. Yes. Yes. If you don't mind, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about the lost years, as it were, as you said. At Fort Lee, what were your responsibilities?
I was the educational coordinator, and set up a training program. This was the beginning of folks getting activated for Vietnam.
Yes.
So I envisioned what, you know, I really didn't know much about Vietnam, didn't know much about war. I made some assumptions from what I'd seen about some of the casualties. So I'd made some assumptions about what our medics would be exposed to if they were assigned to a field unit and became combat medics. So I set up a training program for them to become field medics. And even before I left, ended up having our first graduating class. And so that was really very, very satisfying, because by that time I was on orders for Vietnam myself, and then it was like, mm-hmm. sure hope you trained your troops good enough.
Well, what about those assumptions that you made with your own experience in country later on? Did they turn out to be fairly accurate?
Well, yes, no question about it, because okay. without the experience that, or without the combat or field medics, those casualties would never have made it into the hospitals for our care.
Yes.
So those field medics were just extraordinary, because they saved lives to bring them to the hospital. And in Vietnam, we had the fewest casualties of any war, both in terms of those that made it to the hospital and in terms of survival. And, I mean, there's no better example, I don't think, than the fact of people who were quadriplegic, who had been had neck injuries and were unable to breathe on their own,
mm-hmm.
Being able to be evacuated in, first they were taken care of in the field, then they were bagged on the choppers and stayed alive, were able to be kept alive long enough to end up dying on the ward, mm-hmm. because they couldn't be evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they were, you know, it's hard to know from the perspective of the medic, but I can't think of anything that we could have done in the training of them to prepare them any more than what we already did.
Now, how did it come about that you were put in charge of the development of the curriculum?
Because I was a captain.
Okay.
So depending on what their needs were and what the rank of an incoming, there's no assumption when you're in the military that anybody has any better or any worse experience or expertise than the next person.
Okay.
So it's first come, first serve.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I should say that in Germany, I had ended up as the nurse educator for a while there also. So I had that on my, curriculum vitae, if you
sure,
will.
Sure, sure. Uh-huh.
So that may have, swayed them also.
Now, how many training medics did you have in that first class?
Probably about 20.
And did things go smoothly, or did you learn as you went along some adjustments or tweaks that needed to be introduced for the next class?
I just was there for one cycle.
Okay, yes.
And so I don't know how they may have changed it subsequently, but we had, I ended up leaving, but there were other people and training medics that stayed on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suspect that the program changed as they got to know more.
Sure. At what point did you volunteer to go to Vietnam?
We had gotten to Fort Lee, and Harvey was part of a new, he had changed from armor to supply and service because he had decided he was not going to be a career officer. And so they switched him out of combat arms to a support corps.
Yes.
And he became a supply and service sort of logistic officer. And then was part of a new unit that was being created and activated to go to Vietnam. His unit got orders, and so I went to Washington again, requesting that if and when my husband left or was activated, that I be allowed to go also. And they said, not a problem. He got orders. I got orders. His were canceled, and mine were not.
How were his canceled? Do you know what the backstory was?
No, I think the unit was probably just not ready, or that they didn't have a place yet identified where they would end up going.
Okay, but your orders had already gone through.
My orders, and mine were not canceled. So I ended up leaving about 2 months before his unit ended up being reactivated to deploy.
And did that introduce stresses between the two of you?
Well, hang on just a second. I'm going to take the phone with me because
okay.
I have to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
So if you hear, are we taped?
Well, I can cut this. Actually, why don't we take a break for a minute?
Okay.
Greta, can you tell me about your trip to Asia?
Well, it's complicated.
Sure.
It's not just like hopping on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I flew to Seattle. I met his parents for the first time. We've been married a couple of years and still
wow.
hadn't met.
Uh-huh.
And bought some property while we were here. And then he flew with me to Travis Air Force Base. And it was one of those strange scenarios that one sees in the movie where I was on the airplane and he was on the tarmac waving as I took off into the wild black yonder.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was an aura that if you went to Vietnam that you might not come home.
Yes.
And so there was a certain amount of angst, again, of what have I gotten myself into, and at the same time, there was no question but that it's where I ought to be as an Army nurse.
Can you talk a little bit about that sense of duty that you had? This has come up earlier.
Well, I think for me, the military had been so important in terms of giving me a direction and a sense of value and importance and part of giving something back and making nursing a meaningful profession, so that this going to Vietnam was the climax of it all.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also the sense of not really knowing what anything about it. I had gone directly from Fort Lee, a supply and service, laid back, relatively post,
sure.
without any training for or personal training for what it would be like to go into a combat zone or what it would be like to be in war or Vietnam or anything else.
Right.
So there was a great deal of uncertainty, and not the least of which is, am I going to die over there too? And so with that, then flying over, there were three nurses, three women on board the plane, and we flew, landed briefly in Hawaii, and then continued on, landed briefly in Japan, and then to Vietnam. And we ended coming into Vietnam airspace when it was pitch black.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter where you looked, there was just no lights, which in itself was strange. And then all of a sudden, we saw this intermittent flickering of what must have been a huge explosion. I mean, even as we were looking at it, was wondering, you know, we were civilians at heart.
Sure.
Wondering what this thing could be, and then realizing that, of course, the only reason for repeated explosions like that would be some sort of an ammunition dump. We were landing during Tet of 1967.
Yes.
And the ammunition dump had been hit at Long Bend. And so when we landed, of course, we heard all of the percussion, the explosions around. And a young man came on the plane and said, you know, don't worry, folks, you're not going anywhere until the armed escort is here and your bus arrives. And it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
What is this? I mean, it was this reality shock. And we then waited for a while and then got on the bus. And it was hot and humid and muggy. And just, I think we women had all curled our hair so that we would look professional as we got on our plane, the plane and everything, and we walked off the airplane, and our hair went, you know, just absolutely straight.
Right.
And so we got on the bus, and there was mesh all over the window.
Mm-hmm.
And it was thinking, now, why is this mesh here? And you realize then that, well, that's probably to keep out somebody throwing in bombs or grenades or anything like that. But everything was new.
And you had had basically no briefings on these kinds of issues?
No, none at all.
There
had been absolutely no briefing. I'd gotten my orders, and that was it.
So you had had no acculturation to Vietnamese politics or society before
No.
you arrived over there?
No, I do not recall even one letter of welcome to Vietnam other than from the chief nurse, but certainly none that was done at Fort Lee.
Okay.
So while we were waiting in the bus, there was another young lieutenant that came and said, you are in, let me see if I can quote this correctly, you're now in a country of the unwilling leading the incompetent into something that is totally fruitless. And it was like, what type of an attitude is this? You know, we were thinking that we were there to defend the South Vietnamese from being overrun by the communists so that they could self-determine. But here it was, unwilling being the American service member, the incompetent being the Vietnamese, and that all of it was for naught. And that was the first sort of real shock of pessimism. mm-hmm. that we were faced with and introduced to when we got into the country. We then took the bus through a little Vietnamese town and it was just, you know, a devastatingly poor with hooches and lots of kids, and realizing that any one of them could have, you know, sabotaged our intent to get over to the military base. And we then ended up at the 95th Replacement Station, which was a whole bunch of hooches for and tents mm-hmm. for people who were getting ready to come into country before they were assigned to their various places, or someone came to pick them up for us to get clothing, to get somewhat acclimated, and then to move on, either coming into or out of country. And the three women, mm-hmm. We ended up living in sort of women's quarters, sort of a large outhouse. And the first thing we did the next morning after we arrived was to cut one another's hair. We realized that this was not going to be anything other than hot and muggy and miserable.
And so did you gals actually do that then?
Yes. We cut one another's hair. And
What were the names of those two other women that you were with? Do you remember?
One, it was Sue Dunn.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But the other, she would know.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Is she on your list?
No, she is not, but I will invite her.
Yeah, she she extended over there, and we ended up working at the same hospital, and our connections were curious when we came back. She ended up coming to the University of Washington. She ended up being part of the same unit that I was a part of.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So at any rate, we stayed about 5 days at the replacement station and went out with some young Special Forces guys who took us over to their base camp, and that was the first time that we had an opportunity to fire weapons.
Okay.
And they taught us, I must have had some other earlier experience as I think about it, because I must have had some breaking down of the weapons and things when we were in basic training that I just didn't recall mm-hmm. when we were talking about it, because when we were in Vietnam firing the M1 carbine was not the first time I had fired a gun.
Okay. So at some point earlier.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. and it must have been in the military, because it was not my civilian life, and
sure.
my father didn't do it. So I must have had some training that I just didn't recall when we were talking about that.
How did you gals hook up with these men from the Special Forces camp?
We were women, and they were men.
Got it. But they wanted to...
So they took us off mm-hmm. the post so that we would have an opportunity to see a little bit, you know, of Highway 1. And what their base was like. And it turned out that they really had a second agenda also.
No kidding.
And it was not sexual.
Oh, okay. There was an additional agenda item.
Yeah.
Okay.
It turns out that the medics with Special Forces mm-hmm. not have any access to medical supplies. They are not part of a regular chain of supplies. And so they have to scrounge all of their medical supplies, and yet they also provided all of the care for the Vietnamese that were working with them. So that meant that we became their resource.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Once we ended up at the hospital,
sure.
Which was actually what happened,
mm-hmm.
that they scrounged and we worked with our ward sergeant to get them whatever it was they needed.
Okay, and to get extra a flow of basic things to them?
Basic medical supplies.
Okay, and they were without a supply line of their own?
Exactly.
I remember you mentioning this in the autobiography, And it was extremely surprising to me that they could be left with no source of materials, but that's the way it was, huh?
Well, and you wonder if it may not be set up that way in part because the special forces never know exactly where they're going to be stationed and who they're going to be with.
Uh-huh.
And so developing a supply line may be much more difficult than it would be for a fixed or even a unit that was part of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may have been some rationale that they were also to try to get their supplies and support from the local people.
From an existing...
They were working more with locals.
Sure. Okay. Okay. After your time with the holding company, as it were, what happened to you next?
The phone was ringing the other line, so I missed what you said.
I was just wondering, what when did you actually go out to Long Bend?
The replacement station was just a stone's throw from Long Bend.
Okay.
And after being at the replacement station for about 5 days, both Sue Dunn and I were assigned to Long Bend, the 24th Evac Hospital. And the 93rd was already there.
Okay.
Then they put the 24th there also, because at the time what they were doing was not only was this going to develop into a central hub, it also was that certain types of patients would go to certain facilities so that they could maximize the use of the resources. So that the 24th Evac, for example, had a prisoner of war ward, and also the neurosurgical center. The 93rd had specialized in psychiatric patients.
Mm-hmm.
So that instead of having the resources spread so thinly that everything was half-assed,
mm-hmm.
what they were then able to do was to capitalize on the expertise of certain individuals that ended up getting assigned there.
Sure.
And so the 24th had been open, I think, a week when Sue and I got there.
What was Sue's rank at that time? Do you remember?
Sue, I think, was a first lieutenant.
Okay. And you were, as you said earlier, I think, a captain.
I was a captain. So I was older than and had more military experience than even if you look at the statistics of many of the nurses who were there. And certainly as the years went by, that they were sent younger and younger because they were needed more and more in terms of rotating personnel since we were on a one-year rotation.
Right.
So I started then. I was assigned, was given a ward master and a ward, and they said, you know, be ready to open this by this afternoon. And he and I... we had met.
Yeah.
We'd met our physician, who was going to be our ward physician, and an empty ward, and began making beds and setting it up and looking at the supplies and not having a clue, but then figuring that neither did anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so we began that afternoon to receive medical patients of all kinds, and none of the experience that you have in civilian life or stateside can prepare you, because you in combat end up with, the first thing you think is in a combat zone, you're going to have combat wounds. Well, the majority of problems are medical problems. And I think it's something like 10 or 15% of the actual patients end up with combat wounds.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority are medical, and like fevers of undetermined origin, and ruling out for malaria, and dengue fever, and typhus, and trench foot, and pneumonia, and gastrointestinal stuff, and malaria, if I didn't say that already.
Okay.
So there are these peculiar new diseases and problems that these guys come in with. So initially, we certainly knew, you know, how to admit a patient and that sort of thing. But then over time, became very good at the work that we did. So it was a very wonderful indoctrination. And then, after about 6 months, I was invited to become head nurse of the neurosurgical unit. Their head nurse was leaving, and Don Patrick, who was the chief of neurosurgery, invited me over, and I couldn't think of anything I'd rather not do,
mm-hmm.
and said that I was perfectly happy where I was. And then, you know, he still continues to be quite the charmer, and talked about my leadership skills and said all the right things. And so it was, again, why not? And, you know, when you're flattered, sometimes you don't realize what you're getting yourself into. But it certainly was a challenge, both from the neurosurgical perspective and also from the dynamics and the responsibility. So I went over and became head nurse on the neurosurgical unit. And that, I think, continued to that experience altered, I think, the rest of my career and thinking about life and death and the importance of having a vision. And there were many who could not make it there because of the devastation of the patients. But one of the things I used to say then, I learned to say very early on, and that I have used actually throughout my nursing neuro career afterwards, is that you cannot reflect on what a person was before they were injured or had their stroke or you know, traumatic event. You have to remember what they were like when they were at their worst, so that everything from there becomes an improvement and a challenge that they have been able to reach and succeed, whether that be to move a finger, to make a sound, to swallow, to urinate, that can't think of the fact that they may have been the cream of a crop before their injury. And I think for many families, that over the years, as I have worked with families and with patients, that may have offered some solace.
Greta, let's take a break here.